and welcome to Season 3, Episode 16 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winsenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. In today's episode, Justin and I ended up reflecting on truth, humility, and the development of doctrines as we walked through our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week. I see that you
just so I can say I'm drinking coffee. I
saw that you had to reach behind you for the coffee there. So I'm guessing you have an answer. So what are you drinking for coffee?
Yeah, I mean, we ask each other this every week. What the truth is, it's a pretty boring answer usually, because it's like I'm either drinking the Caribou coffee that I get at work, or I'm drinking to-go coffee. I'm drinking just a Starbucks espresso in the can.
All right.
And I like to keep some in the office, but that's what I'm drinking right now.
No, I can't remember. Are those sweet?
Yeah, these ones are sweet. Okay. How about you? Did you have coffee this morning?
I did. Yeah, there's a... I think I've mentioned him before. There's this guy who has this bicycle cart that he brings to a little market that's down the really close to us. And I walked down there this morning and got a flat white, and it was delicious.
Nice.
Although it was not the best coffee I had this week. And I'll tell you more about that in my highlight.
Ooh, nice, nice. Well, do we want to go there, or should I start with my highlight, or do you want to start with your highlight? I think
let's leave the tension in the air and go to your highlight.
Okay.
Because I know everybody's dying to know about this amazing coffee I had. So, but yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. I'll do two quick highlights then. The first is that your colleague, Mike, is in town.
Yeah.
And we're going to get together out here at Crown. So I'm super excited about that. That's because great. I had a chance to, I can't remember if I first met Mike when I came to visit you guys here this summer. I feel like I might have met him before. I know he had been at Crown before, but I don't know for sure if I'd met him then. But but I had a great time with you guys. We did a little tour of the city, sort of a historical and even socio-political sort of tour of parts of Berlin, with some sort of intentions, I think, of thinking about whether it'd be possible to do a student trip there. And so it was great to tag along with you guys and to get to know Mike a little bit more. So I'm excited he's in town. So that's one highlight. Nice. A second highlight is we started our semester, and I've got something new on my plate this year where I'm teaching a course for our honors students.
Yeah, because this is a whole new program, right? So complete redesign.
Yeah, whole new program. And I get the intro course with them, which is a course where we're exploring the concepts of truth, but also looking at critical thinking and writing. But one highlight for me is, for one, we've got about 12 students that are in this course.
And this is the honors cohort, is that right?
That's right.
Nice.
Yeah, that's right. So we get some really good conversation going. But I told faculty this the other day in our meeting, but I threw them into the ringer a bit and made them write a paper day two of class, essentially.
I love it. That's something I would do. I love it.
Done by day two of class. So like first day of class, they show up and I'm like, you got a paper due on Friday.
They're freshmen, right? Like this is their first year.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And a couple things about that. Number one, any of our former students who know me well will know this is not how I do things usually, but I gave them almost no instructions on how to write that paper. Like I literally posed them a question and said, you better answer it. That was it. And told them how long it needed to be.
Yeah.
And then I said, oh, and PS, you should be ready to read it in front of other students in class on Friday. So that was the assignment. Anyhow, that's not the highlight. The highlight was the second day they show up, every one of them have their assignment done, and every one of them like wants to read their paper almost, which was kind of fun. So I did say to the faculty, I think this is the first time ever where I've taught a freshman course where the very first assignment, every student turned in their assignment.
Oh, that's so exciting.
It is. And I said that to the class and they're like, well, yeah, we're honor students. I'm like, okay, you've got that.
I love it though. The trajectory that sets for the next years for them, that is so exciting. Yeah. That's wonderful.
And just to say this, I actually love teaching our general student population, students who aren't ministry major, students who have no background reading the Bible and who maybe don't even have a lot of experience writing papers and aren't necessarily polished academically. Like I love teaching those students. This is just a different experience, and I love it also and for different reasons.
But
yeah, it's been fun.
Great.
Yeah. How about for you? What's been a highlight for you then? Tell me about this coffee.
Okay. So I took a few days and went to Helsinki in Finland. And
oh, that's right.
It was
yeah.
so good. It was a vacation. And also we have every month we have 3 focus days that we can apply for to focus on something that's important to Envision Berlin. So one of those is a prayer focus day. So that was the first day. So I was sitting by the water, you know, journaling by the water, and you know, there's this island in front of me, and yeah. And my first 10 years of life or so, I grew up by the water, by the ocean, and I just miss being by the water, by the smells. And yeah, I just, and this is not open ocean at that point, you know, it's quite a ways, in, but I just really, that was good. But the coffee was so good. And I think water is really good there. So the water in Berlin has, you know, a lot going on in it. It's kind of, it reminds me of Minnesota water, you know, but yeah, anyway, the water was so good and the coffee was so good. And I could taste, you know, those kind of berry notes, like from the coffee cherries in the coffee. And it was just like, just plain old filter coffee was so good. So that plus smoked salmon and salmon soup, man, which was a new thing for me. And then, all sorts of things with blueberries and, you know, pastries and other things. And yeah, just a wonderful couple of days of really a very quick trip, just 2 nights, there, but yeah. And it's not far away. It's just an hour and 40 minute flight away.
That's crazy. It's interesting you're mentioning this water thing, because I've heard similar things about coffee and how much the water impacts the flavor of the coffee, which makes sense, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
there's
of course,
so much water in coffee. And also, I have a guy I play softball with who's a brewer, and he runs a brewery here in town. And he was saying some of the same thing about beer. Mm. Like he said that he had somebody whose brewery he went to, and he tasted their beer and it was way off, and they even knew it was off, the people brewing it. And he said something like, "Well, are you treating your water?" And they're like, "Well, what are you talking about?" And he's like, "You got to treat your water, like the water, like and the chemical composition of the water in terms of some of the things that are in city water, mm-hmm. apparently can really impact that." So it's interesting to think about that when it comes to our beverages, on like how much the water that's being used can impact that. So,
well, the coffee there is so good that apparently, according to my travel guide, which was in German, so that was fun. I got a German book on Helsinki and was using that. But if I understood it correctly, Finns drink more than a liter of coffee per person on average a day.
A liter a day.
Yeah. And I asked, so I was there with a friend, and we met someone who was a friend of his who is from Finland. And he said, that sounds about right. I was like, wow.
So if you have a documentation of that, could you please send it to me? Because that way when I'm down in the Crown.
I'll see if I can find it and snap a pic and show it to you. Yeah.
Well, mostly because when I'm in the Crown coffee shop, whenever they're giving me some flack about it, I can say, "Hey, you're lucky that I'm not in Finland, because I think I'm still behind Finland." Yeah, Helsinki. You said you're in Helsinki, right? So I'm still behind the Finns when it comes to coffee consumption.
Yeah.
So what about a low light for you?
Oh, I don't even want to go there, because this is the way that my week has been, is I've had some really good things happening in it, but there's this big cloud overshadowing everything. There's a guy who is a pastor in Minnesota, who I knew, not, he wasn't my pastor, but I knew him, who was charged with criminal sexual misconduct. And he also had been an adjunct instructor at the college. And so, just the layers of anger, you know, with what he's done, and with concern about who he's hurt. I don't know who the victims are. And also the concern about, are there more victims that we don't know about? And just, trying to process a little bit of, what's the institutional responsibility? You know, were there things that I could or should have done that I didn't? I didn't know that this, looking back at old interactions, and just thinking, okay, could I have seen or known or somehow done anything that could have prevented that outcome. And I don't think that there is, but I want to be really honest with myself about it. And I just, but just the heaviness, I mean, just the such significant heaviness of that. And the, yeah. And then hearing that, in other people, as well, talking with, I've had a couple of face-to-face conversations with people who had been students, there, as well as, interacting with some people online who had been students there. And then, I mean, of course, I don't think you can talk much about it because you're still there, but I think, just the heaviness of all of that. And I hate that this happens. And I hate the way that that we haven't stopped it, you know, that we haven't. Figured that out and ways that there's organizational complicity and individual complicity and allowing circumstances where that keeps happening. Obviously, ultimately the person who did the thing is the person at fault. And so I'm glad he's being held to account for that. But yeah, that's it's a pretty heavy low light.
Yeah.
How about for you? What's a low light?
I know some of our listeners might be aware, but the Christian Missionary Alliance, you know, the denomination that Vision Berlin's affiliated with, that Crown's affiliated with, they have some plans, I think, over the course of this next year to be discussing some issues related to pastoral titles and whether or not women and men should be able to have all of the pastoral titles that are available. But I guess I don't know if it's a low light. I guess it's maybe more. I mean, I just caught wind of some of the conversations that have been happening within the Alliance regarding this. And I think I have a concern on a couple of fronts. Some of the concern is that for some time, it's kind of been understood that this wouldn't be primarily a theological debate, but that it might be a debate more around church polity and issues of sort of pragmatic ministry. And I find that to be really unsatisfactory because, to be frank, most of the people who land on certain sides of that particular conversation do so because of their theological perspective. So I think to kind of
and not because pretend,
To pretend that like it's, no, this is just a practical thing, that I think is unsatisfactory. However, from what I can tell, the ways that the Alliance is considering maybe engaging some of the theological conversations and some of the biblical passages, to me, it feels a little bit lacking in some areas. I don't want to be overly critical because I think it's very important for pastors in the Alliance to contribute to this conversation. I've said something to some of my colleagues here at Crown about how I do find it kind of interesting that the Alliance doesn't always tap into folks in the colleges who have PhDs in theology and New Testament and Old Testament. And I'm not saying that just because it's like, oh, woe is me, I feel left out. I don't really feel like I have to be one to be a contributor. However, the fact that it doesn't appear that many are at all makes me wonder, because there's some, and that doesn't say a pastor shouldn't theologize or that they're incapable of handling the scriptures and whatnot.
Right, but we had Joel, who's, you know, with the Center for Pastor Theologians, right? Like that there's absolutely a goal.
It is an absolute goal. And I do appreciate the hard work that's being put in by pastors to theologize about this. But there are also some things in the way that I've seen in lines of thinking that concern me a little bit, because it would be things that I think theologians and folks with PhDs would catch, you know, like would be a little more cautious. And are trained
to catch, right? Like
that's, and are trained that's, to catch. Yeah. And I
think that's part of the point of getting the PhD is to notice certain.
Yeah. And I don't think this has to be it should be the PhDs speaking on the subject. No, I think it should be pastors and PhDs and laymen, or for lack of better words, laymen and women. So I think that it's mostly a matter of like, why not use all of the resources that we possibly have within the denomination? And maybe they will. But I feel like at this point, some of the conversations I've been hearing feel like maybe there's some missing pieces there. And so it'll be interesting to see how this takes shape over the course of the next year.
I think where it could be okay for it to be only a practical conversation is, one of the things that I like about the Alliance is in a lot of issues, it's kind of had this approach of being a big tent denomination where there's a lot of different theological beliefs. And we basically say those are not the primary theological beliefs. And so we can agree to disagree on any number of topics. And I think if that's the decision. And then the practical outworking of that is to say, okay, so practically, how do we have a coexistence of two different theological beliefs around the topic within the same denomination? I would be okay with that. And maybe even appreciate it. I think what I would be not comfortable with is if that's a way to avoid having a hard conversation because we're afraid of, I think there's a real, what I'm having trouble getting out of my mouth because I feel like I will say this wrong. But I think there's this question of who do you alienate if you go to the place of saying, okay, this is our theological position. And is it worth alienating those people? And in either direction, right? There's whatever your decision is. And so that's where I think a kind of more like the theological, if the theological decision is that the unity of the body matters most and that this is not a core issue. And so there's a range of acceptable practice and here's how we pragmatically handle that.
Yeah.
I think I'm okay with that. I think, and I think I'm repeating myself now, if we're just being evasive, then I don't like it.
But isn't this interesting? What you even mentioned though about, I'm having different theological positions like within a denomination, that's a theological paradigm in and of itself.
Yeah.
Like what if, and this is interesting thought, what if the conversation wasn't even about present your best biblical evidence for your view? What if the position was the strongest possible argument for the coexistence of differing theological positions within denominational communities?
Yeah.
Like what if that was the paper? If that were right. The paper, then it would be like, this is all kind of not as important. Meaning not to disregard
important. It has real impacts in people's lives, right?
What I'm saying isn't that the issue isn't important. And any of our listeners who are former students of mine will know that I don't think that about this issue.
Yep.
They will know it because if they took Romans with me, they will know. Absolutely. And if they took prison epistles with me, they'd know even more because I think I really honed it out there. However, what I'm really meaning is it would completely change the direction of the conversation. And I know that maybe there's some of our listeners who are feeling like, are you guys serious? Like you're having this conversation. It's stupid maybe, or the fact is that it's archaic and that we should be way beyond that. And to our listeners who might feel that, trust me, there's parts of that I really am sympathetic towards. However, I think at the same time, these are the kinds of conversations that need to be had in these denominations to get further along that point. To be honest,
it's sometimes a slow and painful process.
It's a slow and painful process, I do understand too that there maybe are some of our listeners who might feel like the fact this conversation is even being had in the Alliance is the very reason why I don't want to be part of the Alliance, right?
And from two different perspectives.
I think of our interview with Dr. Holly Beers, who we had some time ago now, but I remember I was a little surprised at her response when we were discussing sort of this particular issue.
Yeah.
Because I know Holly's take theologically on this, and she even mentioned her take theologically on this issue. And then mm-hmm. she talked about how she likes to roll in circles with people that she disagrees with. And I thought, man, I wouldn't have the guts to pull that same, I wouldn't have the guts to do what she's doing. Like it would be deeply frustrating. And she even mentioned that. She says she's got, female colleagues as well who are just like, I can't fight this battle. And I think she's understanding of that, but I also do think of the women in particular in the denomination who feel like that the Alliance is their home, and they're dissatisfied maybe with the current state of affairs when it comes to this particular issue. And so it's a good conversation.
I really hope that in the process that those voices are heard.
That's very important too. And even in saying this and talking about the matter of there being theological schools and whatnot, to be frank, I think a concern of mine in even saying that is that I'm not aware of how many Alliance schools have Bible or theology professors that are women. So for me to even say that, to say, oh, hey, we should be engaging voices in the Alliance that have PhDs about, like, that's still fairly limiting, And
right.
So anyhow,
I know Crown did at one point, but doesn't currently.
Yep.
does in your department, but not in that specific field.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'm speaking more specifically of PhDs in Bible and theology. And so that, then that in and of itself is a wider issue that, you know, we could address another time, but, and of course, I think maybe some of our listeners would be like, hey, how convenient for you to say you're a male professor at a CMA, you know, school.
Right. Well, what's an insight for you?
I'm not much one into the denominational politics and knowing how a denomination should or shouldn't work. I am licensed with the Alliance, but I've never been a part of any conversations regarding policy or how things work. However, I do think that, like, there is something important about reflecting on the process when it comes to all these doctrinal things that are being reconsidered as to, like, why we feel the need to even comment on some things. This isn't one of those. I don't want to give the impression like, hey, look, we shouldn't even be talking about this. But I do find it interesting the things that denominations choose to explicitly state and things that they choose to not comment on, right? And I think we had a conversation about this related to when I went to the UK. And we had this off the record conversation, but when I went to the UK and I visited my school over there that I graduated from my PhD with, and they're a British evangelical institution, but to see their, like, doctrinal statements and the things they choose to comment on, the things they choose to just, you know, leave a great deal of diversity on. Like,
I do remember talking about that. I don't remember whether we published it or not.
So I don't mishear me, folks. I'm not saying, oh, the Alliance shouldn't even be commenting on this. I don't mean that. But what I do mean is, like, has anyone in within denominations ever really sat down and said, like, what has to be the essentials for us? Like, what are the things that we have to state that are just clear identity markers for us as a community and about what we think theologically? And what are things that we want to allow a great amount of diversity? And because if you comment on it, it doesn't allow diversity of opinion. Because if you deviate from the commented articulations, most of the time you're seen as either fringe or potentially outsiders. So that raises some questions, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, and then the fossilization issue that you've mentioned before as well, that there's this risk of, making, like, as we make statements that makes sense in a particular time and space, right? I think that, it also connects to this question of do we recognize that we have a contextualized experience of our faith? And I think if you don't recognize you have a contextualized experience of your faith and you make a statement theologically that connects to your particular time and space, and there's a good reason maybe for that theological belief, and I'm not commenting about any particular theological statement. I'm just thinking in general, the process of theologizing. But then if you say it as though it's a long-term universal truth, right, that you have correctly interpreted and applied scripture, and kind of imply that if somebody has a different perspective on it, that they're necessarily heretical, like that really becomes, you know, you fossilize the faith in a particular moment in time. I feel like it's something I've seen too in church practice. Like, it's really interesting visiting churches that were started by missionaries, you know, 50, 70 years ago, that sometimes feel like a 1950s American church, I imagine, would feel. Obviously, I wasn't alive then, but with both theological convictions as well as 1950s, 1970s, but, you know, in that range, like, the in terms of theological convictions, in terms of practice, in terms of even values that maybe are not really a great interaction of scripture with that context, but are kind of these fossilized ideas of this is the way that. That the people who introduced us to Jesus also told us that these things were true. And if that was done in a certain way, then sometimes there was not also space created for saying, okay, how do we become self-theologizing in the future? And how we recognize what was actually, you know, kind of this unchanging truth and what was actually a response to a particular time and place.
Well, and some of the fossilization isn't so much in the doctrine, it's the articulation of it. And there's this hesitancy in denominations to think that revising the articulation of a doctrine is equivalent to rethinking the doctrine itself. And I'm not suggesting that the articulation isn't related to the thinking about it. It is.
Of course,
But I think that there's this sometimes a sense of threat from denominations, like, to revise the wording is to somehow get Well, I don't know. It's to somehow,
it's like to somehow leave the court. And so here's part of what happens, right? Is these issues become like litmus test issues for, are you, okay. So this totally useless word now, like, you know, are you a conservative Bible believing Christian? Right. I feel like that's a useless phrase because it's now come to be associated with so many disparate ideas. But I think that this, you know, so the issue particularly of the roles of, you know, of gender roles in ministry became one of those litmus test issues for whether you believe the Bible is authoritative. And so then we take that, what is a really interesting and important question of like, how do we apply the authority of Scripture in our life? And we use this really culturally limited interpretation of Scripture
and articulate
that as the test for, do we believe the Bible has authority? And it's really not a great test for that across time and space. So
yeah,
I don't know. That's how it seems to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think
6:30 PM on a Friday when I'm clearly doing my best thinking.
Well, how about for you? What's an insight?
Okay. I've been trying to work on the articulation of this all week. I don't know if it'll be satisfactory here, so we'll see. I think there have been two recent situations where I found myself uncomfortable with somebody who was teaching in the area of other religions or other faiths. And I stopped letting them be a voice that was speaking into what my students were encountering in terms of the study of religions. And then later it came out that something was wrong in that person's life. And I have been trying to figure out like, what was that core thing for me that was kind of the little alarm, you know, that was saying like, hey, something's wrong. And I think so this is a mess, but I'm trying to get the words out and then you can let me know if you think there's anything to it. But I think truth, right? So you're teaching on truth right now. And mm-hmm. I think truth, when something is really true, like it's a truth, it is a thing that is true, or a proposition that's true or whatever, like that thing is always bigger than me, right? It's always bigger than us, because I am finite, and something that's really true, it has a limitless quality to it. Mm-hmm. And so intersecting with truth, interacting with truth and coming to know truth should, I think, always be humbling. Mm. Like when we discover something that's true, we often part of that discovery is like attendant to that discovery is the recognition that there's even more we didn't know. Often truth shows us as much about what we don't know as it does what we do know. And so I think there's this humbling encounter with truth. And I think that there was something about the way that some people, I think that when people have an approach to truth that feels, that comes across more like I have discovered truth and I now own it and I can
pass it on.
I can like dish it out to you, or I can, you know, I can part it out to you. I can impart truth to you because I have it. I am in some way the arbiter of truth. Like, that to me feels like something that's really, really dangerous because there's power with that, right? Like this idea that I have truth and you don't have truth and you need me in order to have truth. That feels like a dangerous dynamic. And it also feels like a dynamic that points us to that person and away from truth itself. And I think that is, I think so the insight probably, like if I were to try to distill it down, would be that whenever truth is not humbling, but instead is becomes a tool for lifting oneself up, that perhaps what is being interacted with there is not actually truth.
Well, and there's something I think, and this is something that's came to my attention recently because of a tweet that somebody made, and it really caught my attention. Because former students who are listeners will might remember this about me, but I was always of the opinion that like I got frustrated when students would use like first person language in their papers, I this, or even second person language of we or something like that. And then I saw this post about. And it came from a biblical scholar who was quoting another biblical scholar saying that there's something inherent about religious studies and biblical studies that requires us to write in the first person.
Yeah.
In this sense, not because it's just your opinion, but because it's a self-involved, personal shaping exercise. And to remove yourself as a participant in the conversation is to just, what's the word I'm looking for? Depersonalize your exploration of the subject. So what I wonder if that what you're talking about, the sense of like feeling like truth is this thing that we capture and then that we can kind of, you know, give off to other people. And there's this almost arrogance sometimes floating with it. And I'm not talking about paper writing, like, oh yeah, that's because they didn't write in the first person. It's not that. But I wonder if it is this thing in academia I think about it, I've been guilty of it at times, not only personally, but also in perpetuating it in students. The idea that the subject of biblical studies and of religious studies and of anything related to theology, it should always be self-involved, meaning that these are related to us in a way that's maybe different than some other subjects. I don't mean to diminish, by the way, any other disciplines, except to say that usually people studying religion, theology, and biblical studies are of the belief somehow and the way within which those relate to claims upon themselves as individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Not everyone will agree to what extent like a biblical text or any text for that matter should have a claim on someone's life, but it's in religion particular where there's a sense of self-involvement and not self-involvement. I'm meaning not self-serving, but I'm meaning a sense of needing to bring yourself into the conversation in ways that puts you in this dialogue with the subject in a more personal way than just studying it as a subject.
Yeah.
So I think there's something maybe it's in perpetuating that has led to some of that approach to truth. I don't know.
I mean, I think some of that's what comes back to why people have such strong feelings like about the issue of gender roles in ministry, right? Of is this thing of, well, if I found the truth, then I need to bring myself into alignment with it. But that I think is at least there's something honorable in it. But I think it's when I've found the truth and I have it. And now you must, bend yourself to the version of truth that I've discovered. And aren't you lucky that I'm willing to share it with you? I don't know. There's just this, and maybe I'm describing something else entirely, but I think there's something for me that feels like this warning sign when truth is not humbling.
Yeah.
To the person who's encountering truth, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm encountering truth, it ought to be humbling to me. And I think every time that I come back to that same truth, it should still be humbling to me. You know, like it's not like it was humbling to me the first time and now it needs to be humbling to you. It's like, no, it is humbling. Yeah.
And I think academia at its best, I'm thinking undergraduate work, graduate work, PhD work. Academia at its best is an exercise in having some confidence in your convictions, but having a great deal of humility, knowing your limitations and knowing that there are parts of conversations that you don't have figured out, or that there are people who have raised issues that you haven't acknowledged or that you need to explore more. But at the same time, right? I mean, it's also feeling confident in your own discoveries on certain matters. And I think if we do it well in academia, it instills that sense of humility, but doesn't lose the sense of conviction.
Right.
And how to balance that sometimes is really difficult to know.
It's really difficult. Yeah.
But I think it's another reason why academia can be important. I'm preaching to the choir here in some ways, right? Like, I mean, to you, at least in the sense that, I mean, you're not in academia in the sense I am at the moment, but, but I know that you at least value it. So anyhow, just something something to think about. Now, man, do we have like almost a full episode's worth right here. Just
I know, I was just thinking about that.
Good luck editing. Yeah,
which I mean, we could just do and take an unscheduled break and then come back and finish the last section of Ephesians.
Yeah, you could. Okay.
Okay, so this was supposed to just be an intro, and we had a lot on our minds today, so we've turned it into a whole episode, yeah. Which is, I think, just fine. But let me ask you then, as we close, where are you finding hope today?
That's kind of a loaded question a little bit in some ways. I mean, I think we've been talking some about institutional structures and even denominational structures as it comes to theologizing and comes to addressing serious issues. And if you say, well, where do you find hope? I mean, if I'm just honest, I think there's a lot of great people in some of the circles that I'm running in. Like, I think that there are people who I just have the deepest respect for that gives me some hope. However, I don't think it's all that bad to just acknowledge that, you know what, like when it comes to institutions and in general, I'm not commenting on any particular ones. There can be hurdles sometimes to addressing anything appropriately, whether it be a theological matter or anything else.
Yeah.
Because the systems are in place that are just, there are all sorts of things to consider. So don't mishear me. I'm not commenting on a particular organization. I'm just thinking for institutions in general, where do I find hope with institutions? My only hope for institutions is that there are people in leadership who are legit and who are rock solid individuals and who are people of integrity and people who are, I mean, I don't use this terminology lightly. I really don't, but I mean this, like people who are connected with Jesus, you know, like that, that's just the truth. That's how I see it. And that's what I would find hope in, because institutions are complicated, man. People are too, but institutions in particular with systems are complicated. So yeah. How about for you? Where do you find hope?
I think, so I have two things in mind. One, is maybe a little bit weird, but I find some hope in Revelation 2 and 3 with the letters to the seven churches.
Yeah.
Which I know we've talked about before, I think maybe, gosh, almost 2 years ago or something. But I'm thinking about sometimes when I see the mess of the church, Revelation 2 and 3 is actually encouraging to me in the sense that it's not a surprise to Jesus that the church is a mess. And he looked at the church and said it was worth doing anyway. And even had instruction for believers who were part of churches that were so messy, right? And it depended on the circumstance, but like in one case it was like, hey, you got to get out of there. And in another it was like, hold on. And I think, just that the messiness that we find ourselves in was not unanticipated, in the sense of churches that sometimes have given themselves over to things that are super, unhealthy. And also that Jesus calls us to something better, at the same time. So it's maybe a little bit of a weird hope.
Can I continue the thought there for a second? Actually?
Yeah. Go for it.
I think this is my hope. Can you erase everything I said previous? This is a weird day today. I want to continue that thought. Actually, is part of my hope, and that's this. I think when I'm thinking now about the New Testament, and I think about what you're saying about Revelation 2 and 3, one other thing that gives me hope is that we get these church communities throughout the New Testament that have deep issues that are being addressed by Paul and by others. Mm-hmm. And what gives me hope is that I don't think I get a sense in many of them, not even Galatians, not even Revelation, that these communities are like a lost cause. Like, and we're talking some really awful things going on in those communities. And like, so if what, where's my hope? Well, man, if Paul had hope, if Jesus had hope, mm-hmm. for these churches like that, why can't I have hope? Right now, that does not minimizing the seriousness of issues going on in churches. In fact, I don't think the New Testament does that either, but it does suggest that there is actual hope for growth in communities who are going through some really awful, difficult, and even, challenging situations. So I agree with you there. And it makes me just reflect a little bit more on some of the passages in the New Testament that express that. Yeah.
I think the other thing that gives me hope, and I think maybe this connects to something we were talking about before, but I'm encouraged. Like when I have been talking with alumni of ours in the last week, interacting with people who are trying to figure out how to relate themselves to some of the things that have been going on, I'm encouraged by the ways that they're thinking about things. I don't even necessarily always agree with them, you know, about this or the other thing, but I think even that like is encouraging that they're thinking for themselves, right? And I think I have a lot of trust in some of these really bright young people that we've had the privilege to work with. And I think that's, I have hope in that. I know every generation runs into its own things. And so I know that they'll run into theirs, but I think, I don't have this kind of like overly optimistic view of that, but I am really deeply encouraged, by some of these folks that we have the privilege of being connected to.
Yep. I agree.
We plan to conclude the final series about Justin's dissertation concerning imperial critical readings of Ephesians in our next episode. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversations and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.